This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Thank you, Eli.
You're welcome.
Today, we have a very special guest, Thomas E. Moore III. He is the newly appointed executive director of the American Friends of the Louvre. American Friends, that's kind of cool. With a decade of experience leading fundraising efforts in various sectors and a profound passion for art and French culture, Thomas is set to lead AFL. Oh, I like that, AFL, into an exciting new chapter. Welcome, Thomas, to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. You know, I wondered, Friends of the Louvre, what American Friends, what is that organization? Talk to us about why we even have an American Friends of the Louvre.
Because
me, I would get a little jealous. I want America to have its American Friends and the French to have their friends. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the American Friends of the Louvre, like many American Friends organizations, exist to support museums, cultural institutions, and organizations abroad. Here in America, we've had a long-standing tradition of supporting France as a country and culturally as a whole. So I feel really lucky to lead the efforts of Francophiles who want to be supportive of the arts and culture abroad.
So, but also I think it's a funding aspect to it because
of course
the way the funding works for cultural institutions in Europe is mostly governmental. And they don't really have a setup or a culture for getting money from high net individuals. And
exactly.
So
thanks for bringing that up.
That's why it exists, yeah.
So a very large part of why we exist beyond sort of raising awareness is raising funds. And Americans have a culture of being philanthropic. And, of course, Europeans want some of that, right? So French people, European people, culturally, they are accustomed to their tax dollars, which they pay heavily in their defense toward their social services of all kinds. They believe the government should take care of arts.
And I'm for that.
I am too.
Okay, yeah.
We need some more of that over here. Right. But in the interim to fill the gaps, we have American philanthropic dollars. So we raise dollars here that we send over there to help them execute on some of their artistic missions.
So let's talk about what is it that these dollars are used for.
Yeah, it varies. Mm-hmm. We've hosted residencies. We've helped to restore paintings. We've helped to implement a relatively new center within the Louvre Museum called The Studio, which is a place for children to gather and hang out while at the museum. Prior to that, there was really no place within the Louvre for students, young people in particular, to touch things, right? You go to a museum, you're told don't touch anything, just look, keep your hands at your side. So this room was sponsored heavily by the American Friends of the Louvre, and one patron in particular who decided, you know, this is important for us to create a space within the museum for people to gather, to draw, for kids to scream if they want to, although we don't encourage that, but a place for kids to be kids within the museum.
So how did you come to get this particular position? You know, I'm looking at you, you're a handsome African-American male.
Why, thank you.
And you are now running this. So how did this happen? Talk to us about your journey, how you got to this place.
Sure. I have been working in the nonprofit sector my entire career. Mm-hmm. And I venture to say even before then, all of my internships have been really focused on mission. So I've felt it really important that I work in a place that is geared towards supporting something greater than me and perhaps greater than the dollar, which may be ironic given that my main job is to raise money. But I really feel like so little of that is actually, you know, shaking a cup and asking for money, and instead rather inspiring people by what we're doing to get on board and say, this is something you get to be a part of, just like I feel so lucky that I get to be a part of whatever we're doing at the museum. So throughout my career, I've just felt it important to be aligned with something greater than self. And in that, I found working in youth and human services at different organizations. I found working for a religious organization at one point, actually, that really implemented human services abroad. And thus, in the last few years, I found myself working in art. My wife and I have been collecting art for many years, and I've collected art even before we were married, and found myself supporting the arts across New York City through different museum groups as a young patron throughout my career. And now as an adult, as I like to say, I get to be a part of adult groups. And those groups are a lot of fun. They offer a lot of travel and exposure to the arts at different levels. And so what led me to AFL and being the executive director, I was fortunate to serve as a young patron co-chair for many years, leading the gala efforts, which took place here in New York City. After that, I'd say in June of 2021, I was asked to join the executive board. And that really gave me insight into being a real trustee at an organization that raises a lot of money. And it helped me personally to understand the sort of psyche that of thought that happens around the boardroom table, right? So claiming my seat there while also learning from other people at the seat who has been there or at the table who have been there well before me. And then a little while after I was appointed to the board, my predecessor announced she'd like to step down after 20 plus years of service. And I'm looking around the room like all the board members thinking, congratulations, who will we find? And they all looked at me and thought perhaps maybe I should step in. And so here we are. I think we're 9 months into my...
It's really recent.
Wow. 9 months into my role, and I've been spending the year calling it the year of transition, where we have implemented new databases, we've explored new board structures, we explored expanding the team, which I'm very grateful to have onboarded a few new people to work with me to push this forward. And here we are 9 months later.
So I imagine it must be events and other things that you host. Is it around the country? Is it New York only? Is it just?
It's around the country. We're really fortunate that most of our members are people who have multiple homes and call home multiple places around the world. So in fact, we've just come from a trip with our members to the Berkshire Mountains where we were.
Oh, I love the Berkshires.
It was beautiful. And we were there for 4 days with our members exploring the cultural scene there. We were hosted by some patrons who have beautiful collections, and we ended the trip at the Clark Institute where
he has a hard job, Eli, but keep going.
I was sitting there thinking he must have need for like a director of champagne or something
really
that we could do.
Enjoy plenty of champagne with our members, and in fact, we had a champagne toast on our final night in the Berkshires at the Clark Institute where we were celebrating the opening of the Guillaume Lettier show, which is an exhibition that really has followed the career of a late 18th century, early 19th century person of color, black person, I'll venture to say, painter, who has been not so well noted in history, shamefully so. And now he's receiving his moment. And that show will travel to the Clark, leave the Clark and travel to the Louvre on November 13th. So we're really excited. It was co-organized, and the American Friends of the Louvre helped to produce the catalog.
So the Louvre also does contemporary shows and stuff like that, or is it, no?
No, this is not a contemporary show.
No, it's not. It's modern
18th century, 19th century.
Oh, 18th century. Yeah. Wow, sorry, I was wondering why.
Yeah.
You know what struck me? It sounds like you were a board member.
Yes.
And then transitioned into leading. I mean, that right there is an interesting story. But you also said owning your seat, you know, your seat at the table. And then you wrote an article about that. Can you talk to us about what inspired that?
Yeah, I just, I think post-2020, most companies, organizations everywhere in the world really felt it time to look at themselves inwardly. And I made a promise to myself, no matter where I was seated post-2020, I was not going to just be a face on a place card, right? I was going to really use my seat to make some noise, make some good noise, as our dear sister Maxine Waters has told us, to all cause some good trouble.
Right.
So with that, I felt I'd be honored to take on a seat at the table here of the American Friends of the Louvre as a trustee. But trust, you won't get someone who's just going to say yes to everything the chairman or anyone else might say. And through that, I've been able to really make some positive change, not to say that there was anything that necessarily needed to change, but I think there's sometimes diversity of thought is really important, where you can now have different perspectives at the table that allow for new opportunities.
You said something, though, that I wanted to unpack about being comfortable with being uncomfortable. How do you make that happen? I'm that girl. I do that, too, but I want to hear what you say around that.
I think it's important to to not be so comfortable when you're in positions of power. And I think being a trustee, you hold a serious position of power. And we shouldn't just be smiling in all our board meetings and just patting ourselves on the back. We should be thinking critically about how we can move our mission forward, whatever that mission may be, but also allow for new thought, new opportunity, new voices to be heard, and think about what's missing. So I've grown up in a household where we were always told to think about, even amongst our friends, who's not there. Like, sure, you have all yes people around you, but who's going to tell you no? And those are the people you want around you to make you better.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Thomas More III. I mean, this is really interesting because I find it just fascinating that you're in this particular space, but there was something in your journey that led you there. What kind of priorities do you have in terms of diversifying what people would see at the Louvre? And this is really interesting because we're here in the United States having this conversation. So some of our viewers may have never been to that museum. But well, I've been blessed.
But this also touches upon the curatorial aspects.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have an influence of that at all. Do you?
I'll go on the record to say we do not.
That's what I thought, yeah.
So I am far from a curator.
But strategy, though, correct?
I think we can have influence on who our visitors are, right?
Right.
So for me, particularly the American visitors, that's something that in my seat I can have some influence over, and ensuring certain types of people have access or exposure. So I think we even use our social media platform as American Friends of the Louvre to really get out the word out there of what's happening at the museum. I think this Guillaume Lettier show is a perfect example, once it opens in November, of a draw that might have people who may have thought otherwise about the museum, like the Louvre isn't for me. You know, I've walked into places before and this just isn't for me. Something isn't clicking with me. But I really do think the Louvre, being the greatest museum in the world, has something for everyone. And that's what makes it so special. While it exists in Paris, France, the collections are really vast and they touch on cultures from across the globe. So I think it's important in our seat to really think about opportunities, not just to allow the mega wealthy philanthropists to have access to the museum, but how else are we thinking about allowing different groups to have access and experiences. And I get to work really closely with some really great philanthropists who are also thinking about this, so we can ideate together on who we can allow the experience of spending time in the museum.
I was going to ask, too, you know, how do you make the ask? I mean, how do you formulate that? Because there's a fundraising dimension to all of this.
Sure.
How do you do that? Because, and not to, that you have to share your secret sauce, but how do you do it?
No secret, I'll say. I think I just speak to passion, right? I think that I can speak authentically, having been a young patron, having being a person of color, being relatively young, what speaks to me and how I can share those stories to other people, I think is really touching. And I think I find that my philanthropist community are people who are quite intrigued. You know, if this did something to me, seeing a work of art did something to me and moved me in such a way, perhaps it can do that for other people. And how do we find opportunities to make it exist for other people?
Any social justice dimensions to the work that you're doing? I know it's over in Europe, and of that you bring to this?
I think my existence in this seat is a form of social justice and activism, and being conscious of that every day as I navigate some of these conversations around impact. The organization as a whole is not a social justice organization.
No.
That is just factually what we are not. But I believe I get to sit in this seat and use my personal beliefs or personal philosophy toward making sure the unknown voices are given opportunity is a form of social activism.
So, Thomas, are you an art? I believe you're an artist.
I wish I were. I am not. But I think I have found my seat in collecting and supporting artists throughout their careers. And so many have become our dear, dear friends, my wife and I.
And were your parents involved in the arts, I believe?
They really got
from
us
my research,
into thinking about museums as a place that were places of belonging for us. So I think through that, and then growing up in New York City, we have such a rich cultural community here that I have always felt very comfortable in museums that perhaps some of my peers may not have felt comfortable in. And I was like, I don't care what I'm wearing. If I feel like going in a museum, I'm going to go in a museum and I'll find something that's for me. Mm-hmm. So I feel really fortunate in that. But no, I'm not an artist. I have a deep appreciation for artists and curators, but we find everyone needs to play their role for the art ecosystem to work. So my role is to appreciate and support artists as best I can.
But and you're not, a collector. Ahead, she's a collector too, yeah.
Yes, yes. Right. We collect and we live with art.
What kind of things do you collect? What kind of?
We, our
do
collection.
Do you have an Eli Kozlansky?
No. Yeah. I'll need to learn about that. But my wife and I have chosen to focus our collection on emerging contemporary Black artists in America.
Yeah, that would make sense, right?
We tend to like to meet with the artists and spend time in their studios before we collect and really feel like we're a part of knowing a bit about their journey. And then having the work acquired and live in our home, we get to live with it. It really feels like a sort of energy transfer happens. So being connected to the artists in that way makes us feel, I don't know, we love it. We love it. We spend time in the Outer Banks where her family has a home. And we often invite artist friends with us. It's a really remote place on the beach. And they feel so inspired. Sometimes they then create works that come from that time period. And that makes us feel really happy, too.
It's interesting you say it's an energy transfer. It made me think of a quote from Walter Benjamin, who was talking about the difference between reading a text and writing and transcribing it. As I said, it was like either the difference between going over by a plane or walking a particular landscape.
Interesting, yeah.
Sounds a little bit like that you have this certain kind of, almost like a... But it's almost like the kindred spirits in a way, right? Wouldn't you say?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you live with these works, and we try to rotate our collection as often as possible. We're in a very small Manhattan apartment, so we get to move things around. It just shifts the energy in the room. Every time we put up a new work, we're like, wow, this is, we're feeling this way or that way.
I want to hear about that shifting the energy in the room. Can you unpack that just a little more?
Sure. I mean, we have some... perhaps dark abstract work, for instance, that had been hanging in our living room for a bit. And we recently put up a light portraiture work. we have a work by Taha Clayton that we really love. It's a print piece, but the image is a Black woman with long locks mm-hmm. that almost go down to the floor. And she's in a field, a grass sort of serene countryside feel with a clothesline behind her, white linen sheets hanging, and she's holding a rifle. Mm-hmm. And so that's just such a powerful image for anyone who walks into our home. They're just in total awe of that image, just as we are, because there's a striking woman in a scene that you'd never imagine she's holding a rifle. Mm-hmm. So it sort of has this, there's real power to that. And it just is a conversation piece. And we like to entertain. So when people come over, we love it, conversation pieces.
It's like a disconnect, yeah, between the...
Yeah, yeah. And it's a beautiful Brooklyn-based artist, Taha Clayton. And we found his work in Miami at Art Basel, I want to say in 2021. Wow. And he's doing great things. And I only wish we found the original piece when we met him, because I imagine that one's just striking. He mentioned it's about probably four times the size of the
print
we have.
Oh, it's a print. Yeah. Interesting.
It's a limited print.
Yeah, cool.
I wondered, in your background, you've done fundraising for a lot of organizations, mm-hmm. and not all of them were in art, right?
Right.
So how does one... When there's so many issues out here, that housing, homelessness, there's food scarcity and that kind of thing. How do you position art as something that is vital?
Good question. That is a great question. I believe I came into sort of owning my seat as a collector only in recent years and working in art. So I just happen to naturally talk about art in all rooms. People mm-hmm. ask about me, and it almost feels impossible to talk about me without talking about my art that we own or the artist friends I have. So I remember one scenario in particular that comes to mind is when I was working for a youth services organization called New York Edge, which services about 125,000 mm-hmm. public school students throughout the five boroughs. I had an artist friend come to a sort of career day, and he is a guy from the Bronx named Justin Galzine, who goes by Club Bum. And the kids still, I ran into a kid on the subway who was like, I remember you brought this artist to the school, and now look at my drawings. And this kid's like, he said he's a freshman in high school now.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're going to continue to talk to Thomas Moore. And you can finish your story about that young person that spoke about the artist, please.
So he came and spoke to, I want to say, 25 students in their Bronx classroom and just showed them his journey. At the time, he had been working on a sneaker partnership with Nike as well. So using his artistic skills to bring, you know, what was normally on a canvas to sneakers. And that was a way to engage with people who may otherwise not have thought about an artist at all. And yet they're getting to experience spending time with an artist. So I think I've just been fortunate to bring my whole self to all my jobs that I've had and all the places I've chosen to fundraise for. And in bringing my whole self, I naturally have been able to bring about art. And whether that be through music or fine art, you know, painting, drawing, sculpture, which is what I'm most in touch with in my day-to-day life.
So I imagine storytelling is a big piece to this, because I'm thinking about the woman that you spoke about in the picture with the dreadlocks and the rifle. You know, can you share the storytelling aspects of the visual art at all?
Yeah, that's a big part of why we chose to focus on emerging Black artists in our collection, because we feel most connected to them. I think they're telling stories and articulating words of experiences that we may not have the actual words to do. So why not let a painting do it, right? And why not let...
You know, picture's worth a thousand words, right?
There you go.
Yeah, right, words. Right, yeah,
but
right.
But there's also multiple languages. Like, so the language we use is like a descriptive language, but there's a language of emotion, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Interesting. So,
yeah. Exactly.
Let's make this complicated.
It's a vision. I'm a complicated dude. No, so it's, but that's the thing about art, is that it's stuff you cannot necessarily put into words.
Exactly. And I think, especially post, you know, the George Floyd tragedy and life thereafter, I think it felt hard sometimes when you're working in existing in very white spaces to sometimes speak about your experience. And we found so many artists during that period. We were scrolling Instagram all the time and reaching out to people and thinking like, oh my gosh, we'd love to live with this piece. We feel so connected to it. It's telling this story, it's telling that story, and thus it'll tell the story of our lives. And we really do think about our legacy. We don't have any children yet. We hope to one day. And passing down this collection, which would really be a narrative of our life experience, is the hope.
Did George Floyd translate to the Louvre? Did that incident that happened in America translate one bit there?
Which incident?
George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd. You know, it had such a profound, impact here, and hopefully a lasting one, but of course that's for us to keep the momentum going. But nothing, huh? Not that they would care, but I mean...
Well, yeah, it's different. It's a much different
culture. It's a different country. Different culture.
You talk about these, it's almost like you're perpetuating a certain kind of legacy that goes back hundreds of years, yeah.
Yeah, I think entirely. And it's important, as I mentioned, for our own collection, that it is speaking to legacy, you know, past, present, and future. And I think for us, we feel very connected to the future when we're dealing with abstract artists. I really feel like they're 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead of what storytelling is happening in the moment. So in recent years, we've been focusing on abstract painters and have come to love many who exist in our collection.
So I would say if I was visiting the Louvre, what must I see? Now, I saw the Mona Lisa. In fact, my daughter has a picture where she's in the front and the Mona Lisa's in the back somewhere. But how do I embrace that institution? What would be the roadmap for me?
Good question that I've never been asked, but I would say, I just think roaming the halls, like just find any gallery and just sit there and experience it. I mean, these things are so old. They tell a thousand stories. And again, the beauty of the museum is that you really can touch on any part of global history and find some piece of it there. So, the catacombs are one section that I personally really like, where you're deep under the museum.
I didn't get there. Oh, wow. Yeah. I missed something.
I'm sure you missed a lot.
I never got there. We had to kind of run through, so to speak, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's just an amazing, storied institution, and I go back every time and find myself wowed, and there are moments where you just sit in awe of whatever gallery you end up in, and you're just thinking about all that went into this, all that exists to keep it up. And again, I think a lot about future. So all that it'll be 100 years from now, 200 years from now, and the stories of our ancestors that we'll get to sort of experience this, but also what's being documented about history in the now, about the curators that are working in the museums and putting on the shows.
You know, we had Sean Decatur, who's the president of American Museum of Natural History. And one of the things they were doing was to rethink the first American galleries, you know, the Native American, and do it from the viewpoint, not from the colonists per se, but from the viewpoint of the Native tribes and
The indigenous folks.
Yeah, so they actually redid the whole section. Do you see something like that happening in the Louvre? Is that something they're interested in, or something they're doing now, or?
No, I think what's most interesting about the museum in the moment is that Laurence Dakar, the museum president, has created a new department. So there are now 9 departments at the museum, which is a really historical time to exist in working in the museum. And the latest department is called the Department of Byzantine and Eastern Christian Art. Excuse me. So with that, the lead curator and department head, Maximilian Duran, has been charged with really pulling artifacts and artworks from all the different departments within the museum and placing them where they belong, which is the period of Byzantine art, so that there's real researchers, scholars, curators focusing on that period of art and giving it its due. And we're actually reconstructing a part of the museum at the moment. Well, it'll begin in January, where there'll be a rebuild of an entire sort of wing, if you will, of the museum that will be dedicated toward that type of art. So I'm just fascinated by the opportunity to get to be a part of this sort of historic moment. How often will the Louvre create a new department? Probably, yeah, this will probably be the last. And the mandate came in partnership with the president of France, because as we know, the Louvre is run by the French government. Unlike many American museums, which are, you know, run by private philanthropic dollars in its entirety, the Louvre is actually the state invests in art. And so through that, the president of the museum reports to the president of the country.
Oh, that's interesting. Isn't it? You know, they're kind of like time bubbles in a way. And, you know, I was once in the Victoria and Albert Museum, and we had the pleasure of running to one of the curators, and had this room there, which is these castings of the ancient stonework from all over the world. They're not the actual ones.
Yep.
But in a lot of ways, it's a more accurate representation because the real ones have been eroded by acid rain. So these are much more accurate. It's funny, like these little time capsules in a way.
Well, I think that's pretty much all the time we have, but I think I want Thomas's job. I think I want his job.
I want to be director of canapes.
I want to come back and be him, right?
Well, there's only one problem. We don't speak French.
No, we don't. No, we do. You're fluent, I imagine.
You must be.
I'm not quite fluent, but... it's been
conversing.
A journey.
Oh, excellent.
Okay, good. That's
so
good to know. You got a shot.
Got a shot, right? Yes.
Yeah. Well, Thomas, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. You know, it's you share some wonderful insights, not only about your journey to where you are today as the director of the American Friends of the Louvre, but, you know, things about the museums one would never suspect.
And he's clearly quite the fundraiser. You know, we're going to have him back and kind of get a little deeper into how he makes it rain, right?
Yeah, of course.
How he makes it rain.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Art Moves. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Art Moves with a Z. You can listen to Art Moves on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Brix Arts Media and recorded at Brix Studio in downtown Brooklyn. I'm Ilya Koslansky.
I'm Tony Williams.
And until next time, keep exploring, keep creating, find some art that moves you, and share it.